children, to have many children on top of that. It is highly encouraged. It is considered the worship of Allah to be married, to have kids, and to earn an income, to go and earn sustenance for your family. Zuhud is unfortunately abstinence from the world. Taqwa, piety, is taken in the wrong sense, where we just stop going to work and become beggars. No, the purpose is to provide for our families. The purpose is to gain wealth and then take that wealth and use it on the path of Allah. Use it to strengthen our communities, strengthen our Islamic centers and our mosques and our Husayniyas, strengthen our fellow brothers and sisters, and all in all, strengthen Islam via our wealth. But of course, while we are gaining this wealth, we should be very careful to not fall in love with this wealth, for our only love should be and must be Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم إني أسألك الأمان يوم لا ينفع مال ولا بنون إلا من أتى الله بقلب سليم.
O Allah, I ask you for the protection of the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعض الظالمون يقول يا ليتني اتخذت مع الرسول سبيلا.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the unjust one will bite his hands, saying, Oh, would that I had taken away with the messenger.
وأسألك الأمان يوم يعرف المجرمون بسيماهم فيؤخذ بالنواصي والأقدام.
And I ask you for protection on the day when the guilty shall be recognized by their marks, so they shall be seized by the forelocks and the feet.
وأسألك الأمان يوم لا يجزي والد عن ولده ولا مولود هو جاز عن والده شيئا إن وعد الله حق.
And I ask ask you for protection on the day when a father shall not give any satisfaction for his son, nor shall the child give any satisfaction for his father. Surely the promise of Allah is true.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In this program I would like to talk about Amir al-Mu'mineen, not that much from the historical point of view, but I would like to share with you some of his words about himself in Nahj al-Balagha. Ali, in the words of Ali, in response to the letter of Muawiyah. This is the early days of the Khilafat of Ali, where Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, was selected by the Ummah for the first time in the Muslim history. If we really look at what is known as people's choice, this was the first time where the people came to him and insisted on him that we would like you to become our Khalifa and leader, to the extent that he says in the third khutbah that the number of people increased so much that my two sons were being pushed and almost crushed onto me, where people were saying, we will not accept anyone but you now as the Khalifa and the leader. And so there, you know, Amir al-Mu'mineen, basically when he got the bay'at from the Muhajirin and Ansar and the people of Medina, as well as the delegations which have come from Kufa and Egypt, then he basically sat down to clean the corruption which was there. So he was going to dismiss many, many people who were in power in different positions. And one of them was Muawiyah. And Muawiyah, basically, he was a very shrewd politician. He wrote a letter to Amir al-Mu'mineen. And the whole purpose of that letter was to provoke Ali, you know, in such a way that Ali will end up writing disparaging remarks about the three Khalifas who came before. And then he would use that writing of Ali among the people of Sham to say, see, he is against the Khulafa that we believed in. Amir al-Mu'mineen responds to his letter. But Amir al-Mu'mineen knew his reason and his motivation. And so Ali responded without giving him the opportunity to misuse his letter. You know, in right in the beginning, Muawiyah, basically to provoke him, started praising Rasulullah. That, you know, alhamdulillah, we had Rasul in our tribe of Quraysh, and this and that, he was this and he was that. And after him, you know, we had the Khulafa. He mentions one, then the second, and the third, and their accomplishments. This was all done in order to provoke Ali against the Khulafa. And Amir al-Mu'mineen knew his motivation. So he now responds to him, and this is in letter number 28 in Nahj al-Balagha, where first Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I'm really surprised and, you know, amazed by you, Muawiyah.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Pakistani politicians and former top civilian and military officials are in the spotlight after they were named in Pandora Papers scandal. There are as many as 700 Pakistani politicians, retired civilian and military officials whose names surfaced in the scandal. Among them also included sitting ministers and close aide to the Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose government came into power in 2018 with a pledge to end rampant corruption. Pandora Papers are based on 11.9 million documents from 14 firms, mostly in British Virgin Islands and the US, where many world leaders and top officials, including from Pakistan, hid their allegedly ill-gotten money by setting up anonymous offshore companies.
How ironic it is. Look at the sheer numbers of military generals and bureaucrats and members of current government who have been named in Pandora leak. They all are involved in this mega corruption.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has ordered an investigation into the scandal.
Although Mr. Imran Khan has been presiding over a team of these crooks and gangsters who have now been exposed in these Pandora's leaks, he has been closely working with these ministers whose names have come up. But at the same time, he would like to distance himself from these crooks and gangsters in the name of the so-called investigation that he's likely to initiate very soon.
Prime Minister Imran Khan's predecessor Nawaz Sharif was ousted from power in 2017 for possessing overseas assets beyond known means of their income after a similar scandal known as Panama Papers surfaced. Since then, many tax amnesty schemes have been introduced to legalize the hidden wealth of politicians and officials in and outside Pakistan in return of tax penalties. Therefore, many believe the corrupt elements are likely to get scot-free once again. Pandora Papers scandal is likely to die down in Pakistan given the fact that this time around the powerful military seems to have no appetite to play its role to oust the current government, unlike in 2017 when the military fully backed the judiciary to oust the then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif after he clashed with the army on issues linked with the foreign policy. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Al-Qassam Brigades, the military wing of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, has held a huge festival in the Gaza Strip to commemorate five Palestinians who were murdered in Al-Quds and the West Bank a week ago. Hundreds of Palestinians attended the festival, raising Palestinian flags and banners, hailing the Palestinian resistance and the martyrs.
These events held in praise of our Palestinian martyrs and their families in the West Bank. Those heroes prove that the rights of Palestinians are red lines. Palestinian resistance movements are gathered here stressing that we're all united in this battle against the Israeli occupation, and the resistance will always be our only path to restore our rights.
Earlier, Israeli forces conducted a series of arrest raids against suspected Hamas members across the occupied West Bank, triggering clashes in which five Palestinians were killed and two Israeli soldiers were seriously wounded.
We are proud of the martyrs who lost their lives while defending Palestine. Our message to the Israeli regime is that we will continue to resist and teach the new generations to follow the footsteps of those who sacrificed everything for Palestine. The Israeli regime keeps killing and arresting our people in the West Bank on a daily basis, and these violations must be seriously dealt with.
Palestinian resistance leaders also attended the festival. In their speeches, Hamas leaders stressed that the resistance is the only option for dealing with the Israeli occupiers. They also stressed the need for promoting the spirit of resistance among new generations so they continue to fight until the rights of Palestinians are fully restored.
Palestinians here stick with resistance to restore our rights in a forceful manner, as this is the only way to defend Palestine. Those martyrs chose their path and insisted on sacrificing themselves for Palestine. Hamas stresses that we are all united in the path of resistance and the Israeli regime must be aware that we won't give up. Our brothers in the West Bank always support us, and in return, we will defend them.
Palestinian factions here express their loyalty to the Palestinian leaders who have lost their lives defending Palestine and vowed that their blood won't go in vain. They also express that the battle against this occupation is ongoing until complete freedom. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
A Sassari appeals court suspended a hearing regarding the extradition to Spain of former Catalan separatist leader Carles Puigdemont. The Italian judges have determined that a rule on the matter will be made after the European Court of Justice announces its verdict on Puigdemont's immunity. The politician's immunity, linked to his election as a member of the European Parliament, was lifted earlier this year by the EU General Court.
Catalan separatist leader Puigdemont is wanted by Madrid on charges of sedition for leading a Catalan bid to declare independence from Spain in October 2017. Separatists' short-lived declaration of independence triggered a major political crisis with Spain, during which Puigdemont and several others fled abroad.
Italy's judges have made their call, and now it's up to the European Court of Justice to make theirs. The case is also a test of judicial cooperation between European countries, which have ruled differently on the same issue.
A German court refused to extradite Puigdemont to Spain on rebellion charges in 2018, simply arguing that the Catalan leader was not punishable under German law. Some Italian lawmakers have slammed Puigdemont's arrest in Sardinia last month, saying it was a dark page in Italy's democracy.
The arrest of a politician whose only wrongdoing, in inverted commas, was organizing democratic elections is a worrying signal. If this is how we deal with forces that gather the support of millions of people against central governments, we should all be worried.
The Sassari court will set a new date after the European Court of Justice decides on the immunity of Puigdemont and on the legitimacy of the Spanish judge to issue the arrest warrant. Meanwhile, Puigdemont is free to travel as he pleases. For the time being, Max Civili, Rome.
Palestinians rallied on Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza in solidarity with thousands of prisoners held in Israeli jails and detention centers. The event comes as several Palestinian political prisoners continue their hunger strike to protest their inhumane conditions. Suffering of Palestinian prisoners has multiplied following last month's heroic escape of six prisoners from Gilboa, a maximum security prison in occupied northern Palestine.
Following the historic escape of several inmates from the Gilboa prison, Zionist forces have placed all Palestinian prisoners under unprecedented, deplorable conditions. Many of them have been placed under solitary confinement and were tortured over suspicion that they had helped the six prisoners. Currently, the prisoners are subjected to 60 types of punishments inside Israeli jails and detention centers, which is a clear violation of international laws and norms.
Last month alone, the Israeli regime forces arrested 350 Palestinians, including 36 children and 11 women. Rights activists say Palestinians held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Prisoners on hunger strike are suffering as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Israeli violations against Palestinians. Some of the prisoners have been on hunger strike for more than 80 days. We call on the International Committee of the Red Cross to exert real pressure on the Israeli regime to end its systematic violation of prisoners' rights, especially women and children.
Every Monday for the last 30 years, Gazans have staged protests outside the office of the Red Cross to condemn Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinians incarcerated in 24 Israeli jails. Palestinian prisoners resort to hunger strike to draw attention to their suffering, especially under Israel's so-called administrative detention, a policy under which people are held for an indefinite period without charge.
We are here to support Palestinians who lost their freedom while fighting for Al-Quds and for the liberation of Palestine. I call on Arabs to wake up and support the Palestinian prisoners. The prisoners need re-election to highlight their ongoing suffering inside Zionist jails.
Palestinians are calling on the international community to come out of its silence and help their loved ones who were incarcerated illegally by the Israeli regime.
Currently, there are over 500 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention. The Israeli regime has arrested almost 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Twelve-year-old boy, the grandson of Iran's health minister, Bahram Einollahi. Mohammad Sadrar received a Sinopharm shot with the presence of the health minister and local media outlets to encourage Iranian families to vaccinate their children with peace of mind.
I urge all families who have children between the ages of 12 and 18 to send their kids for vaccination. This way we can reopen in-person school classes safely in the upcoming months. I brought my grandson today to get the vaccine to prove that vaccines will bear no harm for children.
Iran has so far administered more than 58 doses of COVID vaccines. This means 68% of Iran's population has received at least one shot. This number was less than 10% around 2 months ago, when President Ebrahim Raisi took over power from his predecessor. Iran managed to accelerate the inoculation campaign by speeding up imports of foreign-made jabs, as well as supporting local vaccine developers.
Only in Tehran, more than 10 million people have been fully vaccinated. This is over 70% of the capital's population. The vaccination of lower ages will definitely help us get our kids back to school safely.
Based on the international health guidelines, minus 18 age groups should receive a single dose of COVID vaccine. The Iranian health minister said the country has taken the same approach and will administer one shot to its adolescents. He said once this phase is over, the health ministry will start vaccinating students between 7 and 12 years old.
While Iran lagged behind in the national inoculation program, it has managed to be among the first to inoculate its teenage population. If all goes as planned, children can go back to schools in less than 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian farmers have held a rally outside the United Nations headquarters in Gaza City to condemn the Israeli ban on the export of their produce to the occupied West Bank and abroad. The Palestinians handed a letter to the representative of the United Nations, also protesting the obstacles and restrictions imposed by the Israeli regime on the international marketing of their crops.
The price of tomatoes is dropping and we are not making any profits. This is because there is no export to the West Bank or any other country. Palestinian farmers are living in hard conditions and have a limited source of income. The Israeli regime forces us to remove the tomatoes covers for exports, and this causes damage before they make it to the markets. We want the borders to open so that we can export our crops, and we demand imports of the required tools for farming.
Palestinian farmers say large quantities of their crops are piled up at Karm Abu Salem, which is the only gateway out of the Gaza Strip, and are damaged. They say the Israeli regime has imposed impossible conditions on the exports. The Palestinians say they depend on the crops as their only source of income, adding that the regime seeks to destroy their livelihoods.
No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops.
Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party. Here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Puriza, Manchester.
The Iranian radar system, dubbed Shams, can create simulated electronic warfare scenarios to train fresh military personnel. The system was unveiled together with other defense equipment, all built by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force.
The fully indigenous Shams system is a long-range radar simulator and allows us to design and execute a range of war scenarios. This way we can enhance the preparedness of our staff members against potential missile attacks and other aerial threats.
Hormuz was another radar system that was put into service on Saturday. It's a medium-range tactical radar capable of detecting and tracking air targets at high, medium, and low altitudes. Iran's Air Defense Force says the new equipment will significantly increase the country's air defense capability.
The major feature of Hormuz's radar system is that it can calculate the speed of the target while accurately calculating the distance and sending the data to the fire control systems. I should say that all of the equipment unveiled today and earlier were designed and produced using domestic know-how. We no longer need to import any such equipment from other countries.
Iran has for four decades been under U.S.-led arms embargoes, which prevent the country from purchasing any foreign-made arms. This has over the years prompted the Islamic Republic to try to develop its own weapons to ensure its security. Every year, the country unveils a range of domestically built defense equipment, from UAVs to missiles, as a show of its military might against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic views U.S. sanctions as a tailwind that has pushed the country toward self-reliance. While these latest military equipment can be counted as a case in point, army officials say this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Iran has indigenized over 80% of its defense arsenal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Pakistan has lost tens of thousands of its citizens and security personnel since late 2001 when Islamabad joined so-called U.S. war on terror. Pakistan provided the U.S. with its military bases to carry out attacks on Afghanistan and allow the NATO supply line to pass through Pakistan to the neighboring country. But it all backfired with the retaliatory attacks and massive public resentment against the US and successive governments for supporting American imperialistic agenda across the region. After recent humiliating exit of US from Afghanistan and the return of Taliban government in Kabul, Islamabad has changed its pro-US policy. Now Pakistan has decided to bring an end to 2-decade-long violence through negotiation with the different groups working under the umbrella of Pakistani brand of Taliban movement and other groups engaging in insurgency in southwestern Balochistan province.
In fact, I think some of the Pakistani Taliban groups actually want to talk to the to our government, you know, for some peace, for some reconciliation. And we are in talks with some of the groups. I do not believe in military solutions. I'm anti-military solutions. So I always believe that, you know, as a politician, political dialogue is the way ahead.
Before the change of guards in Kabul, Pakistan blamed India to have been using different militant groups from Afghan soil to fan insurgency in its southwestern and northwestern regions bordering with Afghanistan.
The Ashraf Ghani government and other hostile governments in Kabul were providing them conducive conditions to attack Pakistan. But now that the Taliban are there and Taliban have guaranteed or have assured Pakistan that the Afghan land will not be used will not be allowed to be used against Pakistan.
Many militant groups have repeatedly attacked in Pakistan on Beijing's economic and geostrategic interests linked with its global project known as Belt and Road Initiative. The mega project starts from Chinese province Xinjiang and passes through nearly 3,000 kilometer long road network of Pakistan before sailing through Arabian Sea to reach onwards rest of Asia, Africa, and parts of Europe. Both Washington and New Delhi have publicly opposed the China's mega project, which has challenged the economic hegemony of the U.S. Now Islamabad wants to win over the terrorist groups through a reconciliation process in an effort to wean them away from the foreign powers, using them to disrupt over $50 billion investment of China in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javed, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javed.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about Nazr, or giving food and charity to the poor and the like, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Nazr
little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtadha Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawheed, we are talking about Nazr, or the laws related to vows. And according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and last time there was a mention or a quick hint at the formula and the intention of the vows. And what I wanted to ask you in concession, or following those questions that we started off, in fact, last session, is it really necessary that the formula of the vow be in Arabic?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, according to His Eminence, Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it is not necessary to recite the formula of Nazr or vow in Arabic. So everyone can recite the vow in his own language, whatever the language may be. Okay, but you know, the formula which is recited in any language other than Arabic must convey the same meaning. Okay, it cannot be any, for example, any kind of sentence. It is a formula, and in it the formula should convey the same and the exact meaning of the Arabic formula. For example, if you want to make a vow that you will recite or that you will offer two rakahs of prayer, two rakahs of prayer, you will say it in Arabic like this: okay, lillahi alayya nasum rak'atayn min as-salat. Okay, on Friday, for example, on a given day,
yes,
the day is also fixed. So you will recite the same formula in English. For example, you will say, okay, it's from Allah upon me to recite two rakahs of prayer on Friday, on the coming Friday, or any Friday that you want to offer. Okay,
yes.
So it should be like this. If you just make an intention, or if you just form your intention and say nothing, or if you say something which does not give this the
the meaning of that, the Arabic formula, of course, it will not be binding. For example, if you say, I will offer two rakahs of prayer, it is not binding because you have not mentioned anything, you have not mentioned God's name in the formula, okay? You should say it's from Allah upon me, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's obligatory from Allah upon me to offer two rakahs of prayer or to fast for 1 month or for 40 days or let's say recite the Ayat Kumail, for example, because anything that is preferred, anything that is obligatory can be included in nazar. Not something which is neither recommended nor or neither obligatory or not even not those things which are for example reprehensible or haram. Of course you cannot make a nazar that you will, for example, smoke cigarette or you will let's say drink alcohol. Nazar does not make sense in those cases.
I see. Okay, would you tell our dear audiences about the formula of the vows?
Well, the formula I gave you, I just told you that the formula, if one can speak Arabic and if he knows Arabic,
yes.
Because most of the scholars have stressed on the Arabic formula. Usually, for example, in...
But you said it's not necessary.
Yeah. Even other scholars do not emphasize, okay, on the Arabic formula, and they do not say that it is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But it's recommended to recite the formula in Arabic if one can, because in many other cases, like for example, if you are contracting the marriage contract, if you are concluding marriage contract, the formula has to be recited in Arabic. And if you are not able to recite the formula in Arabic, so you can recite it in your own language. The same is the case with let's say with nazr. If possible, it's good that you recite it in Arabic. Otherwise, you can recite it in English or in your own language, whatever the language may be. So the formula, of course, you can say, you can recite Lillahi Alayhi, because it begins with Lillahi Alayhi in Arabic, okay?
Yes.
And then Lillahi Alayhi means that, okay, it's from Allah upon me. It is obligatory from Allah upon me to do such and such act, okay? Lillahi Alayhi an asum, aw Lillahi Alayhi an usalli, aw Lillahi Alayhi an aqum bihada wa hada. Okay, it is from Allah to do upon me to do this and that act, okay?
Okay.
Now, the same can be said in English, for example. It's obligatory from Allah upon me to carry out such and such actions. Okay.
Or in the tongue, or
yeah.
In the mother tongue of the person.
Yeah, in
pledging.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So you can recite the formula in the language you best understand.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back and discuss more laws on this program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio.
لا إله إلا الله والله أكبر.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We are still talking about the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei about vows, and Sheikh Javid is still with us at the studio. Sheikh Javid, if a person pledges a vow while he cannot afford to do it, is his vow still binding?
Yeah. Well, one of the conditions that must be taken into consideration and which makes a vow actually binding and obligatory is that the person who makes that pledge must be able to do it. He must have the capacity and must have the means to do it. Otherwise, it is not going to be obligatory in the first place. For example, if a person makes a vow that he will, let's say, he will go to Karbala to perform ziyarat, and he lives, for example, he lives in Southeast Asia, or he lives in Africa, and he does not have the money, he does not have the resources, and he cannot actually fly to all the way from Africa to Iraq to perform the ziyarat, okay, ziyarat of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Because he cannot afford it, mm-hmm. so this vow is not binding. So the vow, even though it is recommended, you know, it is recommended, doing ziyarah is recommended. But since one, he is not able to take the ticket, the air ticket, or fly all the way to Iraq, so it's not necessary to comply to take any action.
If it is not physically possible,
yeah.
Like one of these medical conditions,
yes.
or for example, like this COVID-19, you yes. know, afflicted or affected many countries. So there would be no tickets sold or no such gatherings allowed, for example, in a country like Iraq, like those places.
So actually, so he is incapacitated.
Exactly.
Yeah, he will not be able to do any action.
So it's not binding anymore.
Yes, not binding, yes.
And
when it mean when we are saying that it's something that the vow is not binding, it means that he will not be liable for any penalty. There is no penalty going to be obligatory upon him, because if you violate a vow you are able to do it, you will have to give a penalty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you would like to know what the penalty is. You know, the penalty is to, let's say, feed 10 poor people, or if you cannot feed, or if you would like to give clothes to 10 poor people, you should give clothes, okay? Clothes
for every vow.
For every broken and violated vow, you have to give clothes to 10 poor people to wear.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cannot do this, if you cannot afford it, then of course you have to fast for 3 days consecutively, okay? Mm-hmm. For 3 consecutive days you have to fast. This is the penalty of kafara, the penalty or the kafara for violating a vow.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alaykum La ilaha illahum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the book The Inner Voice, Allama Sayyid Sa'id Akhtar Rizvi aptly explains the need for a man to understand his purpose in life and to be able to ponder over some of the important aspects of our journey in reaching nearness to Allah. Today, we will read to you an excerpt of this book. Stay with us. Is God dead? Creation of God, the pattern on which He has made mankind, there is no change in the work of God. That is the standard religion. But most among mankind do not understand. Quran chapter 30, verse 30. They claim that God is dead. They should have said that gods are dead. The confusion arises when false gods are identified as God. An atheist astronaut once gleefully joked that he went high above in the space but could not see the God. So, here is the confusion. The poor soul did not know that God is not body to be seen or found in a place. His joke just confirmed the belief of those who had emphasized from the very beginning that God could not be seen. Belief in a God is as much natural as any natural instinct can be. This eternal truth has been explained in the verse of the Holy Quran mentioned above. An atheist asked Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, how could he convince him about the existence of God? Coming to know that the man has gone several times on sea voyages, Imam asked him, "Have you ever been caught in a fierce storm in the middle of nowhere? Your rudder gone, your sails torn away, trying desperately to keep your boat afloat?" The answer was yes. Then Imam asked, "And sometimes, perhaps, even that leaking boat went down, leaving you exhausted and helpless on the mercy of raging winds?" The answer was again yes. Then Imam asked, "Was not there, in all that black despair, a faint glimmer of hope in your heart that some unnamed and unknown power could still save you?" When he agreed, Imam said, "That power is God." That atheist was intelligent. He knew the truth when he saw it. Today's atheists give that place to nature. The only snag is that poor nature is senseless and lifeless. How a senseless and lifeless idea, because nature is no more than an abstract idea, could create a universe of such magnitude, with such a systematic perfection, uniting millions and millions of galaxies in a well-knit system? How could nature give life and sense to creatures when itself it has none? Thank you so much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was an excerpt from the book Inner Voice by Allama Sayyid Said Akhtar Rizvi. Our website is parstoday.com. Until next time, we leave you in Allah's care.
Plastic pollution has become one of the most pressing environmental issues as disposable products overwhelm the world's ability to deal with them. Indonesian activists have come up with an idea to convince people to rethink their habits and say no to single-use bags and bottles. Environmentalists have created a museum made entirely from plastic waste in the town of Gresing in East Java. It took them 3 months to collect used plastic items, ranging from bottles and bags to sachets and straws. They were all assembled from polluted rivers and beaches. The centerpiece of this museum is a statue whose skirt is made from single-use sachets of household items. The museum has become a popular location for selfies and has received more than 400 visitors since it opened last month.
I will definitely change my life habits. For example, like when I go to the market or to a grocery store that provides a plastic bag, I will switch to a tote bag. And when I buy a drink, I will use a tumbler.
Environmentalists say their plan behind the exhibition was to send a message about the world's worsening ocean plastic crisis. The plastic problem is particularly acute in Indonesia, a nation that ranks second only behind China for its volume of plastics that end up in the seas.
People around the world celebrate the changing seasons in different ways. In the U.S., an annual pumpkin contest is held to kick off the fall season. Each year, farmers and vegetable enthusiasts from across the U.S. gather in New England for the competition. Anyone bringing the largest homegrown pumpkin gets the prize. This year, a man from Abington, Connecticut,